set.
This is the
Antioch Worship Leadership Podcast,
a podcast about worshiping diversely together.
Have mercy.
Let me say it one more time. Antioch Worship Leadership Podcast,
a podcast ministry of Madison Church.
Oh, I got
you're listening to He's My Rooftop by the Mighty Clouds of Joy. This week on the Antioch Worship Leadership Podcast, I have an interview with my friend and former professor, Dr. John Lee. Dr. John Lee has been working with Madison Church on their anti-racism audit, providing wisdom and very well-thought-through perspectives on race and the church. He's going to share some of those here with us. So I hope you enjoyed this interview. This is part one of two, so stay tuned for the second half. Enjoy. Welcome to the Antioch Worship Leadership Podcast. I'm here today with my friend and one of my former professors, Dr. John Lee. So we've been sitting here in a little office at Kelvin College, where I do a little bit of adjunct teaching, and that's actually where I had you as a prof.
Yeah, man.
And thank you. You've been many places since then. I'm going to let you tell a little bit of your your recent story, and then I'm going to ask you some questions.
Okay, man. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, I Eric, this is really neat to connect with you, and today was significant in that, you know, at age 60, I'm trying to get back into the classroom, and here I am back at Calvin College, where it wasn't the first place I started to teach. But I certainly did a lot of significant teaching here in my mind. I mean, there, a lot of stuff happened to me here as a teacher, and so it's kind of fun to be back in this situation, in this setting.
Okay, so you are a doctor.
I have a PhD in psychology, but interestingly, psychology is one of these great diverse fields, right? So I actually have an academic degree and an applied license. So my particular generation, I don't know if this would be able to happen again, but I have a PhD in cognitive psychology, but a master's in counseling psychology.
Oh.
And so when about 20 years ago, it occurred to me that one of my friends said that your master's degree would enable you to get a full license as a psychologist.
Right.
But all I needed to do was get my internship. And when I say it, all I need, I mean, that's significant stuff.
Right.
Internships are important. But internship plus 2 years of experience. And so I went and got that became fully licensed as a psychologist, even though my sort of formal educational training was not in clinical or counseling. That's what I've been doing for the last 20 years, is that kind of stuff. But I love the classroom, and I love teaching, and I love talking.
Yeah, well, that's that's going to be great.
So I love the idea of being in a podcast. This is cool.
So what are some of the areas that you specialize in? I mean, you said cognitive psychology, but you've been helping our church at Madison do some work.
Sure. Yeah. So my first entry into higher education was at a Christian liberal arts college. It wasn't Calvin, but it was Tabor College in Kansas. But by the time I got to Calvin, it became pretty clear, right? And it certainly, the seeds were starting to be planted in my master's degree. My mentor back then was Dr. Joseph Trimble, who's a Native American, Sioux Indian. And he's one of the co-editors of a book, Counseling Across Cultures. Mm-hmm. And I can remember he gave his graduate students sort of the first draft of the very first edition. I think it's in its seventh edition now, right? And so seeds were being planted, right, that somehow culture and race mattered, right? And because up to that point in my life, as a Christian, it wasn't supposed to. Right, that we were all one in Christ and all this kind of stuff. So we weren't supposed to talk about particularly race, but also culture, right? Mm-hmm. If it was culture, then you were a missionary, right? I mean, you were learning another language or something like that. But so, yeah, by the time I got to Calvin then, some things are starting to occur. And I had a good mentor who said, you know, John, you're going to go work at this place in the Midwest and all this stuff, and it's primarily a white and, culturally speaking, a Dutch-American Christian Reformed college. He didn't know that, but he said, because as a person of color, you're probably going to be asked to sit on the diversity committees. You're probably going to be asked to, you know, do this and do this because you're, you know, you're not the same race, right? And, he said to me, don't do that, right? Focus on your scholarship, right? Get tenure, right? And then if you want to sit on those committees later on, you're certainly welcome to. But, you know, just really. But interestingly, where my scholarship was going to be focused was on all those issues. Mm-hmm. And I can remember it was kind of odd because I would get asked to sit on these committees while I was at Calvin. And even though I was doing all this scholarship and publishing books and all this other kind of stuff, right? I'd say, no, I don't want to do that. But they'd look at me, well, but you've just written this article and you just did this. And he said, you know, how come you don't want to do this? I said, that's not what I'm about at this point, right? I'm doing research. And the research was on this whole issue of cross-cultural kinds of interactions. Mm-hmm. And then as I learned, that those are very different than interracial interactions. So this distinction between culture and race has sort of been my, I hate to use the word specialty, but it's sort of my mantra, if you will, right? And my story really contributes to that because I grew up in Canada where the issues are culture. Right. And I'm part of a generation where being a Canadian meant we weren't Americans. And we were trying to really understand what a Canadian culture was. And we could point to the fact that we were bilingual, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, everything we did and said, I mean, it was just so United States-y, and I love that, right? There's no term that just talks about the United right. States. We use American as if Americans are just, you know, it doesn't matter. But anyway.
There's going to be all these fun bunny trails we could go down.
That's right, exactly. That's one of the trails I almost went down to. But given that history and then living in the United States, right? I actually framed it this way in a recent biography, a little biographical statement, that, you know, that having grown up in Canada, where it's a very cultural, culture is salient, right? Moving to the United States, where race is salient, this phrase that I use, multicultural but racialized, mm-hmm. is kind of a term that I'm using, and I'm pretty sure it's going to be a subtitle for some book I do, right? That multicultural but racialized is sort of my forte, if I will.
So, yeah. Okay, so since you kind of brought up the elephant in the room, yes. How would you describe yourself?
Yeah.
In terms of,
yeah.
I don't know, multi-ethnic, racial, what would be the words you would use to describe yourself?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a training exercise that has to do with multiple identities, how we self-identify, mm-hmm. and then how we are identified. Mm-hmm. Different issues, right? How you self-identify and how you're identified are very different issues, especially in a racialized culture.
Yes.
So I identify as a Chinese-Canadian third generation. That's culturally, right? And there's a lot of else the things I could mention there in terms of, you know, cisgender male, heterosexual, middle class, able-bodied. I mean, all that stuff, right, that is who I am culturally, who I've been constructed to be as a member of a culture, right? But I am identified as an Asian. I'm that generation that saw the racialization of Asians, where Chinese and Japanese and Koreans and Vietnamese started to refer themselves as Asians. I'm that generation. Now, we go down the bunny trail of how that happened, but we don't necessarily have to. But I'm the person, not the person, but the generation, right? And as you think about the development of the United States and its culture, right, that doesn't automatically think of myself as Asian. That's how I'm identified, mm-hmm. right? It's not how I identify. Even though I participate and have led and initiated Asian American student groups, and Asian American this, and Asian American that. I mean, I use the term, right? But in terms of how I think about myself, I don't think of myself as an Asian, right?
Right.
That's how the white people think of me. Right?
And so, okay, well, let's actually,
particularly the U.S. government, not just white people.
Let's kind of tug on that thread just a little bit.
Sure.
Because in this podcast, one of the points of it is to learn how to have cross-cultural dialogue.
I bet.
And then especially with its implications in a worship context.
Yeah.
But I think what you brought up is really important because a lot of times in the United States, when we talk about multicultural worship, mm-hmm. oftentimes mm-hmm. we kind of are thinking of bicultural, African-American, and white.
You bet.
And those are kind of like the things that we talk about first. And then it's almost like as an aside, like, oh, and there's like all these people who don't fit in one of those two boxes. Mm-hmm. Not that the people that are put in those boxes in the first place feel like they totally fit in those boxes either. That's a whole another rabbit trail. Yeah, exactly. But like when you said, okay, so people describe me as Asian. I don't think of myself as Asian. Right. Can you talk about that a little bit, where that comes from?
Right. So I grew up in a place where the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans and the Vietnamese all lived in different places and had different places as communities to sort of sit. I mean, you can find that in Los Angeles. You can find that in Seattle, right? But you can also find now in 2016 Asian American neighborhoods, right, where those groups have sort of, the term is pan-ethnicity, have come together sort of under this banner of Asian, okay? So what I'm using is a personal example of what we call racialization, right? And that culture has been racialized in the United States. So when you talked about multicultural worship, what usually goes off in my people's minds, okay, and you could probably prove this empirically, right?
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, that they don't think of cultures in the way that I'm using the word. They think of, like you said, almost just two races, right?
And it's like very binary.
And it's very binary, exactly. So to move to... from the word multicultural to multiracial is a major step for people, right? Because what multicultural is a binary black and white, right? If you start to use the term multiracial, people go, oh, yeah, there's other races, right? And so then they think about, you know, Asians and Hispanics and, you know, all this other kinds of stuff. But to me, that's still all racialized. Right?
Well, it is. It's kind of like breaking it down just one degree more.
1 degree. Right.
Right.
Exactly. And I love the way you're doing this because I recognize in trying to explain this to people, if you break down multicultural, right, it goes into multiracial. Because what multicultural means to most people is either just black-white.
Right.
I mean, it isn't what I use, what I think about when I use the word multicultural.
Right? And on this podcast, like, that's one of the things that, that I'll keep bringing up as long as I'm doing this, that we need to know what our terms mean, because sometimes when we're talking, we might have to go back and say, like, okay, now what do you mean when you say this? Because sometimes we even interchange terms
That's right.
Oh, wait a minute, actually I'm not being very clear here.
Right. That's right. Yeah. No, this is very helpful in terms of me being able to communicate about what I mean by multicultural.
Yeah, and that's important for where you're going to go
with
this in just a minute. So you also used, I believe, just a few minutes ago, the idea of, like, racialized.
Right.
Okay, can you talk about what that term means?
Sure. Okay. So part of me hesitated because I use pictures now, right? So
right.
We'll draw a picture, right, that you draw a circle that represents humanity. Mm-hmm. The early race theorists, right, drew three circles within that large circle. And those three circles represented what they called races. Mm-hmm. Okay? And it was French. The term was a French ideology. Right? Not ideology. What's the word? The history of words.
Yeah, ideology.
No, that's what causes things. It doesn't matter. But anyway, where do words come from? Right? Etymology.
Thank you. You're right.
Okay. So the etymology of the word race is it's rooted in the term ratio in French, which translates in English as species,
and
breeds.
And it was kind of taught like that too. Actually, I found a history book at my grandmother's house.
Yeah,
where in that book they called it the Four Races of Man, and it was right after this little section that was on like the animal kingdom.
Yes, because it was rooted in Darwinian thinking, right?
Yep,
the idea that Darwin had explained the diversity, the differences among animals, right, on the basis of an evolutionary process of survival of the fittest and fit with the environment, right? What was it? I'm forgetting the term. Survival of the fittest and natural selection, right? So the environment selects and that kind of stuff, right? So, I mean, scientists were impressed. Hey, look at this. He's predicting this. He showed us how this has worked out at the Galapagos Islands and all the rest of it. It wasn't that part of a step to go, how do we explain the diversity among humans, right? And so it was, maybe there are different species of human beings, right? And this whole, then that notion of race, right? And unfortunately, and I would have done the same thing, right? They didn't have any technology to determine a species. That is, they couldn't do a genogram. Not in a sense of genotype. They couldn't do genotype, right? So they couldn't break out your DNA and look at all that kind of stuff that's going on there, right? But they did have phenotype. And what phenotype is how people look, right? So the most salient thing these early colonists, because that's what they were, these were early European scientists, trying to make sense of the world as they saw it, as they were colonizing the world, right? They saw all this diversity, all this, what I'll use the term, all this cultural diversity. And they were trying to explain it through sort of the Darwinian kind of metaphor, right? That there were different species, right? And so the differences of language and foods and dress and religion were the result of genetics. So this is what's beneath race theory, right? That it's really a genetic biological theory of human diversity. Okay? Now, it turns out, and I got to throw this in right away, it's wrong that there is no biological correlate for race. That the Genome Project essentially showed that to us, that when we outlined all the different DNA strands and all the rest of that kind of little allies with it, you couldn't, if you showed someone a genotype and said what race they were, you can't tell. It's not marked. Right, so this phenomena of race, of dividing the world up into these different species, is a social construction. That it wasn't a biological basis. It's no biological. I mean, a nice way I often say in my classrooms is that I look at people and I say, "So, have you read any research on race?" Yes. Did you know how the races were divided? I mean, how did they determine who was white and who was black and who was Asian and all the rest of it? Right? And I say, "Well, it's usually just self-report." As people tell you what race they are, or you look at them, and based on phenotype, right, check off that. And you probably know there's a lot of people who you can't tell. You know, that it's not real, and we call it, I hate this term, racially ambiguous folk, right? That you really can't tell what race they are, right?
Well, here's one that's really interesting is that they're doing some of the same research to see, like, okay, how much Neanderthal DNA are in different people.
Right,
and like most people would say, okay, Neanderthals aren't human.
Right.
But yet
they are.
There's like 0.3 you know, percent that's like somewhere in there, and and it's different proportions, and it's just I watched a video where they were giving people their reports.
Right, right.
And just like, you know, it was just like this weird thing in their head that like you know, oh, I'm part cave person.
That's right.
Right. It should have to just kind of sit with with this information.
Right, yeah. You know? No, because it really challenges some of the narratives or mythologies that we have of where we all came from, right? But let me go back to race, because it goes back to that whole narrative, right? These early race theorists were Europeans.
Yeah.
Right? So they're traveling around the world on their boats, and what they're doing is they're colonizing all these places, right? So they're seeing all this cultural diversity, and they're trying to make sense of it, right? So they start to name the races. Now, that's what I'm saying. It's important here because this is an issue of power. Who gets to name who, right? So they name the races, right? And the one race that they name, which everybody's heard, right, around the people who come from Africa as Negroid. And we get the N-word from there, right? But the term, the Negroid race, right, was the people from Africa, right? And they would point to, and there's, you know, textbooks that you can go find out, they would sort of say, here's the shade of skin, and here's what the lips look like, and the nose, and the hair, right, and all that kind of stuff. And then they described another race, which they called the Mongoloid race, which is what we call the Asian race, and I'll explain why it shifted from Mongoloid to Asian in a sec here, right? Okay. But what's really telling is what they called themselves, these early European, right? And they were talking French, we're talking German, we're talking English. And notice what I just did there. These are the cultures of Europe. Okay? So these cultural groups, but they share a science. I mean, they have a conference in Paris where they speak French, right? And at that time, if you were educated, you spoke four or five different languages, right? But they had one of the first race conferences in Paris, right? They came together and said, you know, what are we going to call the races, right? And one of the terms that was proposed, and it's lasted because it's still used today, right? To refer to the white race, what we call the white race, was Caucasoid. You had Negroid, Mongoloid, and Caucasoid. Okay, be sure to ask me where the what we call the brown race or Hispanics fit in, because they're not actually a race.
Well, that's what I'll say on a lot of the, like when they like white, not Hispanic.
That's right. That's right. To the U.S. government.
We had to come up with a whole special term to point to the ambiguity.
Because Because some of the sociologists who were consulted when we devised those terms for the U.S. Census, right, knew that Hispanics were not a race, even though they may look like it, even though you got white, black, and brown, and yellow, right? And it was talking about worship. I mean, I grew up. Let me just say this, because I'll forget. One of the ways in which we get racialized as Christians is we learn a little song in Sunday school called Jesus Loves the Little Children, Red and Yellow, Black and White, right? That's racialization. That is, we're thinking about differences among humans in terms of color, red and yellow, black and white. And I wrote a little article on this. I get the meaning of that song. Jesus loves everybody. But Jesus does not think of the children as red and yellow, black and white. We do. Jesus was not racialized, right? Yeah, but we are. And I'm not saying racist here. I'm saying racialized, right?
Yeah. Well, okay, so as an artist, I pay attention to pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of times, pictures that kind of go along with that same kind of song.
Right.
Depending on when the picture was made.
Right.
At one point, especially in the U.S., all the kids would be white.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when that song started becoming very popular, like, oh, actually, when, you know, Let the Little Children Come Unto Me.
Yeah.
It would always be like, okay, there's going to be a child who's like brown or tan or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But the kid sitting on Jesus' lap is always white. Yeah, and it was like,
interesting.
And I was like, boy, doesn't that just kind of tell you where your spot is?
Who gets to sit in Jesus' lap? Wow.
And now that's less and less, but I mean, you can still find examples, and it's like, okay, so the signals that the church sends tells people about, like, okay, well, how.
Right.
How important are you? Right. What do we expect of you? What's your role?
Right, exactly. Which goes back to Caucasoid. Because Negroid was based upon the idea that the black race, the Negro race, right, evolved from the Nigris River. I shouldn't say out of the river, but in that area, right? And Nigris is black in Spanish, right? So you got Spanish people naming the race of Africa Negro. Because they believe that this race, this species of human beings, evolved out of this Nigris River Valley. Same thing with Mongoloids, right? Mongoloids, right, evolved out of the Mongolian River Valley, right? The species of human beings. Caucasoid, what's that about? The Caucasus are a group of mountains, right, in sort of Eastern Europe. Where did that come from? Why were these anthropologists referring to themselves as Caucasoids? I mean, why didn't they pick a river? The Thames River or the Seine River in Europe. I mean, no, they don't, because they were not evolved.
Oh, right? They were human?
They were human, exactly. So, yeah, Darwin had this idea of evolution, right? But these are Christians who believe in the creation story. We have no indication in Genesis that somehow we came from animals, right? That somehow we were created by God, right? Caucasoids, because they were, well, I should think, the Europeans who named themselves as Caucasoids, right, do not see themselves as being a product of evolution. They were created. Okay? But why Caucasus? And here you go to the old Jewish story, and I know you probably heard this because I might have told you at one point, right? Because the Noah story, legend has it, right? Legend has it that the ark ended up in the Caucasoid Mountains. Now think about what that story is, though. He was the remaining human beings after God destroyed everyone else. So essentially, when you label yourself as the Caucasoid, you're basically saying subtly, and in some ways explicitly, we are descendants of Noah. We are descendants of God's chosen people, right? So these are scientists, but they're also Christians. That is, their theories are influenced by their religious thoughts and beliefs and mythologies, right? So that what they're doing is they're connecting themselves, they're connecting their species to God's chosen people. Hence, one definition of racism, right, is the belief that you're a part of a superior race, right? It's embedded in the very word that we use to describe white folk, right? Now, we use the word white, and that's another story about where that term white came from, but Caucasian, which you often will hear now, but Caucasoid is the Latin term, oid in Latin is from the Caucasus, Negroid, oid from the Nigris, Mongoloid, oid from Mongolia, right? You get the etymology of that, right? Caucasoid reveals and deconstructs what I call sort of the false scientific and very poor theology and the racism that lies beneath race theory, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a theory to try to understand why human beings are different from one another, but it actually is an ideology that's perpetuating the idea of the superiority of the Caucasoid race, right? I once had somebody, when I told them that, they said, so I should probably not call myself a Caucasian anymore, right? Because I'm sort of playing into the idea that I'm superior. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, I get that, right? I mean, but I don't find that offensive or anything, right? But what I found offensive is that people don't know that. That they have no history of where race theory came from. And how race theory was essentially, and I like to use this, right? Race theory was a pseudo-theological, pseudo-scientific theory to justify colonialism. Because if you were God's superior race, if you were God's chosen race, then you could do whatever the heck you wanted in this world.
Which is kind of where Manifest Destiny and some of these...
Exactly.
I mean, it's the natural outgrowth of this.
Exactly. That's right. And again, I don't find the word offensive. I don't even find the theory offensive. I understand why that theory developed. What I find offensive is that people don't know that. Right? That, you know, we don't have what I could call education that's authentic to issues of power and privilege and ideology. That it's usually education just simply to bolster a particular ideology.
Are you familiar with Mark Charles? Mm-hmm. Do you know him? Okay, you should meet him sometime. Okay. Anyway, he's a Navajo man in the Christian Reformed Church. And one of the things that he talks about is that the reason these conversations are so difficult is because we don't have a common memory.
Beautiful. Well put.
And so I'm like, this is absolutely part of what needs to be part of the common memory so that we can say, as one humanity, to look at this and say, like, we all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God.
Yeah.
In specific, this is one of those sins, is to think that I am above my brother or sister for this reason.
Right.
And to be able to just call it out and call it for what it is, not from a place of shame, but just because, like, we need to have a common starting point so that we can figure out what we're trying to fix here.
That's right. You bet.
When God makes all things new, that kind of means that certain things are needing to be made new.
Yeah. I remember talking to an Ojibwa woman, and we were describing these stories, and she knew very little about Christian history, but she knew her Western civilization. I mean, she had been educated in America. Mm-hmm. She's like, so, John, you're telling me that the Christian faith is indeed responsible for the very idea of race, right? I mean, it comes out of Christian nations, right? These European nations, right? And I go, yeah. She says, wow, that means it's probably not going to go away very soon. And her comment was, because Christianity, and I'm not talking about, you know, I mean, as a culture, right? It still dominates our mythologies, our thinkings, and all that kind of stuff, right? And I'm so glad. I mean, it was my generation that we saw the World Council of Churches, we saw the National Association of Evangelicals, right, make explicit comments, national, international statements of, we blew it. We're responsible for racism. We named it, right? We did that. And even the anthropologists have done that, right? The anthropologists have said, we're responsible for the notion of race, right? And we want to take that back. It's this neat thing called the American Anthropological Association Statement on Race. And it's beautiful, right? Because we blew it, right? Culture explains human diversity. Now, here's this back to the word culture, right? Culture, etymology, Latin, cultura, to cultivate. The metaphor there is that people differ because we grew up in different soils or different environments. It's not different species or genotypes, right? It's different environments. So you can have, you know, someone who looks, and I'll use racial terms, black, grow up in a white neighborhood.
Right.
Right. What's their culture? Their culture is whatever that culture is of that neighborhood. I'm not going to call it white culture. I mean, I like to use this. When I was teaching at Calvin, I would occasionally have students, right, who were adopted Koreans. So they were born in Korea. They looked Korean. So I'm using that racialized notion there, right? But they weren't Korean. Their culture was, they grew up in Linden, Washington, or, you know, Hudsonville, Michigan. They were Dutch Christian Reformed, culturally, right? Mm-hmm. So here they are in this racialized United States. People were calling them Asian, right? And assuming that their culture was Asian. But look at their names and, geez, your last name is DeVos. Your last name is Hooksima. I mean, you obviously must be adopted, right? I mean, it's this idea, right? But that person, that narrative I just described there, they are this kind of example of how culture is not race. Culturally, they're Dutch American CRC, right? But they're racially perceived, right, as Asian, right? And getting back to the worship issue, right? Yeah, I love what you did there. What most people think of is when they think of multicultural worship, they just go to the binary of black and white, right? So to help people expand their notions of what worship could be beyond just black and white, probably the best word is to use multiracial. Mm-hmm. That there are other races, and I hesitate saying that because I don't want to perpetuate racialization, but there are other races that do worship. That there might be Asian forms of worship. There might be Native American forms of worship. There might be Hispanic forms of worship. And I'm going, yes, please do that, right? Please embrace the fact that there are other forms of worship besides either black or white, right? Mm-hmm. But another part of me goes, but don't stop there. Because among the so-called Asians are an enormous amount of cultural diversity, right? The Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans and the Vietnamese. I mean, those are deep, rich cultures and different languages. And why it's important for me to do that is that these are also different expressions of Christianity. There is not such a thing as an Asian expression of Christianity.
Correct.
There's a Chinese expression of Christianity, a Korean, right? A Vietnamese and all the rest of that. Now, you can't say that for black and white very quickly, right?
But the histories are different there.
Exactly. That's right.
So... okay, so if I was going to say back to you what I'm hearing,
okay.
One of the takeaways, if this is kind of like a new idea, is that, okay, so for me as a white person, if I'm trying to understand, okay, I've got a congregation full of people, mm-hmm. there's some people that I think they look some kind of Asian, those same people may see themselves... okay, who am I in relation to the dominant culture, which may be in, mm-hmm. we'll say white.
That's fine, I get it, yep.
And that maybe there are some other people who are the dominant minority culture, maybe it would be black, maybe it would be Hispanic.
Right.
But in terms of thinking about myself,
right.
who I am,
yeah.
yes, I'm Asian because that's what people think,
right.
but who I am
right.
is... like Chinese or
Japanese or Vietnamese.
But then it may even break down another layer.
Sure.
And be like, okay, and what place?
Right.
From my, you know, in my home culture, like how far down does this
exactly.
go? It's like,
yeah.
Like the forks in the road can almost get endless.
Oh, you bet. Because my Chineseness is Cantoneseness.
Yeah.
So it's an ethnic group in China, Canton yep. province, right? And that's the brand of Chinese that I am.
Which is important.
Exactly.
Because the difference is that people would say, okay, Cantonese is different because...
yes, exactly. Different histories, different language, yeah. right? Different expressions of what it means to be a human being, right? I mean, yeah, all that richness.
We preserved our language.
Exactly right.
And, you know, there's certain foods that are indigenous to the region and ways of celebrating holidays that are different from...
exactly.
from mainland Chinese.
Yeah. See, now it's really neat to do this with Asian cultures or Asian ethnicities, ethnicities within Asian cultures, right? What we did there, if you can use the language that I'm using, right? There's such a thing as what I would call sort of Chinese culture. And within Chinese culture, there are various ethnicities or subcultures, right? This is really neat to do with so-called Asian cultures, right? We could do it to Japan. We could do it to Korea. What the challenge, Eric, is to do it to blacks and whites. Because the ethnicities and cultures that exist within the so-called Asian race, the ethnicities and cultures that exist within the so-called Hispanics, are still fairly intact.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
So you can find Mexican versus Cuban versus, right. you know what I mean, those kinds of ethnicities within the so-called Hispanics are still fairly intact, right? They are not so fairly intact among whites and blacks. And here's the question. Why?
Yeah. Well, okay, so both of us in this case would be outsiders. Well, yeah. No, actually, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I just did it. That was an interesting mental.
Yeah, but I get it.
My wife's Chinese, and I yes. often will start thinking.
Yeah.
Oh, but I can't. Maybe I'll even have to edit that out. But
see, but I don't know. I mean, I look at you and I see white, but that may not be your racial identification, right? You may racially identify as something else.
Okay. No, I do. I'm definitely Dutch.
Okay.
I'm, well, see, I'm that Dutch would be American.
That would be my language. Your ethnic identification, right? Your cultural ethnic identification.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So to be able to, well, see, now that I just did it, though.
Right.
Is that, like, the way I think of myself, I know I'm white.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to identify that way. Like, I know yeah. that I come from this kind of, like, minority group within whiteness.
Got it. Well said.
And I know it's different.
Yep.
And I know it's specific.
Yeah.
And there are things I love about it and things I really resent about it.
Right.
But it also shaped me so profoundly that I can't say that's I'm not.
Right. And that's exactly what culture is, right?
But I'm not sure that all white folks have that same perspective because...
No, you're right.
And I think... You tell me if this is on or off here.
Yeah.
But when people immigrated...
Yeah.
I think pre-Civil War immigration...
Yeah.
And post-Civil War immigration yeah. may have something to do with this because...
Right.
Many... Hispanic folks, many Asian folks came to the United States
right.
after
yeah.
the Civil War.
You got it. You got it. Yeah.
My ancestors came literally like 2 years after the Civil War
right.
and settled in intentional ethnic communities
right.
where they then shut themselves off, except in cases of emergency,
right.
from the broader, who they would call the Americans.
You got it. That's right.
And only after, like, World War II. Or the
Brits. They might have said Brits or English. Keep
yes.
going. Yep, yep.
After World War II, when the Dutch, who kind of always saw themselves as sort of like an offshoot of Germany.
Right.
Had to say, we're not German.
That's right. It's because of the war, you bet. Yeah, yeah.
Then started thinking of themselves as, I'm American.
Yes. Yeah. You bet. And let's stay with that. One of the reasons I think that occurred, now again, I'm an outsider. But I've read James Bratt. Right. Is because calling yourself an American instead of Dutch came with benefits.
Yeah, there's power with it.
You bet. And one of the most significant benefit that came was post-World War II, right? Which was the housing. Mm-hmm. The loans that were available to vets, right? And where you could choose to buy a house, right? Was all determined by... Not your Dutchness, but your whiteness. If you're white, you could get this loan and you could live here. Okay. If you're black, you could get this loan and live here, right? That kind of stuff, right? Asians are not included at that point. But you get the idea is that the shift in how you identified and how you were identified came with benefits and privileges, right? Which are embarrassing.
But white people chose... To be white.
That's right. I should say this.
African
Europeans
slaves.
Chose to be white. Exactly. Yep.
Yep. In some ways, like, Africans. Descendants of slaves.
No, that's right. They did not choose.
They didn't get to choose.
No.
And so, but it also was the block that made the most sense, right. in some sense, because you could cluster together around this shared experience.
Right. Of enslavement.
Of enslavement.
Right. So you think about, because what we're doing here now, if you think about sort of chapters in a textbook, right? I haven't told you the story of how Asians got racialized. I can eventually get to that. What we were doing before we went to enslavement of blacks was we were starting to give an example of how Europeans got racialized, how European ethnic groups started to think of themselves as being Caucasian and white, right? There's a whole lot of other stories we could tell you about that, one of which is fascinating. Where's the first time the term white, not Caucasian, the term white shows up in American legislation? It's actually colonial. It wasn't in America, hadn't even been formed yet, right? It was a piece of colonial legislation where, you'll love this, only whites could bear arms.
Well, that would make sense if we're talking about power.
Why? Well, because you had all kinds of slave revolts.
Right.
People were enslaved or revolting all the time. And people were enslaved weren't just black people. there were quote-unquote European slaves. One of the great books on this is How the Irish Became White. Right. Right? I mean, so one way in which the slave owners, right, the colonialists, dealt with the slave revolts was to divide the enemy, divide the slaves. So we're essentially going to form partnerships with the white slaves. It sounds funny to say it this way, but it's really with the Europeans by saying only they can bear arms. So then they become a part of us. We give them some privileges. They get a better house on the plantation, right? And everybody who doesn't fit into what we consider to be white, right, cannot bear arms. Isn't that fascinating? The very first time they used the word white is used is in the context of power, right? In control.
Well, I think that was the, yeah. I mean, if you're the power-holding group, that's the big, exactly. The big word. That's why, yeah. When the Haitian slave revolt happened,
we know like, this. Yeah.
Okay, we're totally not publishing this in the newspaper.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Again, that's that common memory, right? I mean, what I just told, you know, I found out, 10, 15 years ago, right? And I'm 60. So where's this higher education? Where's the stories that explain who we are today, right? And there's very select stories that are told depending upon where you go, right? There is no common memory, right? There's some common mythologies that perpetuates oppression and injustice and all the other kinds of things that go on there. Yeah.
Do you know the story of, maybe you probably do, some of the Chinese immigration laws?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. The exclusion laws.
Do you know about what some of the workarounds were?
No.
Oh, I thought this was super funny when I read this. This was in, it'll hit me later. Yeah. I can cite it later with this episode, but when Chinese people realized that the white people couldn't tell the difference between them and Mexicans.
Exactly.
When there was like the Chinese Exclusion Act, somebody's like, you know, we just don't have to land in San Francisco. Like if we just go south of the border,
go a little further south.
we can buy a poncho and ride a donkey across the border and they don't know any different.
Isn't that great?
And so they're like, sure, I'm just coming in from Mexico. Yeah. Fine, come on in.
Yeah. But even, as you know, historically, and some people who have had a common education will know something about the Chinese Exclusion Act. Notice it's not Asian. Right. I mean, it was specifically Chinese people. That is, at that particular time, they were not thinking about people from Asia as Asians. That didn't happen until the 60s. Right? Civil rights brought the term Asian. Right. That kind of. But we got to finish this point very quickly. Right. How did African Americans or blacks get racialized? The very business of slavery destroyed all the cultural diversity from Africa. Because as soon as you got on the boat, those slave owners knew that if we put everybody from one village on one boat, they could talk to one another, one boat, right? They could talk to one another and organize a revolt, right? But if you took them and you divided them up, so the cultural diversity within Africa, as you're collecting slaves, I hate saying it that way, right? As you're enslaving people, right? You essentially intentionally destroy their cultures by putting them with other people from different cultures, even though they looked alike. Again, from the Europeans.
To the white people,
right?
To each other.
There was enormous cultural diversity that still exists, right? But as soon as they got on the boats, right, that starts to get destroyed. And the African American History Museum in Detroit puts that in reality. The very first thing you do in that museum is you start off in Africa and you experience the cultural diversity that was there. You look at the language, the food, the dress, the art, right? And then there is literally a slave boat that you go on as you move to America. And I've been there and I've seen people get onto the boat and fall down and weep. Mm-hmm. And not just black people. Mm-hmm. Because you understand what happened at that point. All that rich cultural diversity in West Africa, in all of Africa, right, was destroyed through this enslavement. And part of why I wept is that all that richness of God's expression through those cultures gets destroyed. Mm-hmm. That's how I said that. That's why culture is so important to me as someone who believes that the incarnation is critical. That is, God comes through culture. God is not above culture. But it's through, and it's through cultures, not a single culture, not just reformness, not just Mennoniteness, right? Not just through Catholicism, right? But through all the rich experiences of other cultures, through other languages.
Which is, in the irony of that, in some ways, is that slave owners knew that there was diversity because sometimes, at least early, they would ask for people from certain tribes.
That's right.
Because they had a certain kind of a job that they needed done.
That's right.
And so,
those tribes had experience of doing
that. I want someone who has essentially, in a really corrupt way of saying it, like, I raise cattle, I need someone with cattle, with herding experience.
Exactly. Shepherding, herding.
Yep. And so they would.
Clearing land.
Yep. And so they would. And they figured out, like, this group of people's really good at that. So the idea of, like, I want the benefits that the culture brings, but I don't want the risks.
Exactly. Well put. I've never heard it put that way, Eric. That's beautiful, man. You got it. And I mean beautiful not in a good way, but that cultural diversity has always been with us, right? But it continues to get, taken over, accommodated by racialization, So you want to take the rich stuff, but not take the stuff that's good stuff.
And that's one of the things that is a concern for me, doing worship leadership, is that we don't want to repeat this same pattern
good where transition. We're like,
we want,
that's right.
You know, we want someone with music experience.
Yeah.
But we don't want,
right.
We don't want the story that goes with that or the pain. We don't want to deal with that part. We just want to celebrate. And
that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, I want different rhythms, but I don't want to know where those rhythms came from.
Yep, and I would really like it if they could do those rhythms within the time parameters that I'm still comfortable
That's in. Right, within my European time frame. Exactly.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, when you're talking about Asian-ness.
Yes.
Okay, last night, there's a new chain, the Walk Box.
Okay.
In Grand Rapids.
I've been there.
Okay.
Yep. It's out of Canada, actually. Came out of Canada.
Oh, is it? Yep. Is that where it's from? We were wondering.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of these places where a lot of times you go out and, you know, if you're going to get some kind of Asian cuisine, it still carries, you know, the cultural label. Like, oh, we're going out for Japanese.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Oh, but that's not just, it's not soba noodles and sushi. And
right.
Okay, right. We're just going to,
right.
You know, you go out for Chinese, you know what you're going to get, Thai, et cetera.
Right. Yeah.
Walk Box.
Exactly.
We're calling it after a cooking utensil.
Right.
But then it's also kind of this mashup of...
You got it.
And I'm like, okay, now is this like all like Asian cuisine, pan-Asian cuisine...
There you go.
That's kind of modified to a Western palate.
You got it.
And we can put it in a little box.
That's right.
Exactly. Which sort of has like little hints of...
That's right.
Of like Chinese carryout to it. But it's like...
That's right. You nailed it, man. Here's the academic... Walk Box, P.F. Chang's.
Right? Yeah.
Those are examples of the commodification. Did I say that right? Commodities. Yeah. Making a commodities. Making it something that you can sell. Right. Of the racialization of Asian cultures. So you take the best. Right. You take the lettuce wraps. You take the sushi. You take this. Right. And you all put it under P.F. Chang's menu. Or you take the best, like you said, and put it under the Walk Box. Right. And so people... can go and go, oh, yeah, I'm going to have sushi here, I'm going to do that. But you're talking about very different cultural food ways packaged in America under this racialized term Asian, right? And it makes sense why Wall Street has done that. It's because it's far cheaper to market to a race than it is to cultures because there's an enormous amount of culture diversity. So, you know, we only need one ad instead of six.
Right. But then there's also a lot of editing that's going on there. Like, there's certain flavors and textures that are not hitting the market at all.
Yeah, and you leave those out.
And it's sort of like, who decided that this couldn't catch on?
Yeah, which focus group, right? Yeah.
You know, for me, like, when I'm in Hong Kong...
Yeah.
One of the things that always stands out to me when I'm in church is that, like, why are all the instruments Western?